Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The mask mandate ruling and the latest on the upcoming Sussman trial. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast, through the miracle of Zoom, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, how are you?
Good, Andy. How are you?
I'm doing great. The Mets are 7-3. How could I, you know, can count on us to win April every year.
Yeah, well, I do this hit every Monday morning on the Sid and Bernie show, WABC in New York City. And I was joking with them this last Monday that I've become a Mets fan. I just can't take the Yankees. Even when they win, I can't take the style of baseball where they can't hit. It's so frustrating to watch.
It's tough to watch. I mean, they have to get regular offense back into the game again, because it's killing people to sit there for 3+ hours and watch guys who either hit home runs or strike out. It's painful.
Yeah, there's a story today in The Athletic about how hockey, NHL has had this renaissance of scoring and how great it is for the fans and for the game. But maybe baseball will evolve in a more entertaining direction our lifetimes.
I don't know. You know, when I see that, I hate when they decide to like artificially juice it up. Because in football, I now get frustrated watching. Well, I get frustrated watching football for a lot of reasons, especially
ETS.
All the ETS. Yeah, well, that's the main problem, I guess. But the thing that drives me nuts is I'll see a guy make what I always have thought to be a really good defensive play, a really good tackle, and it's a penalty. Like you either hit him too hard, or you hit him too low, or you hit him too high. But they've made defense illegal, and it's not. The game's not as enjoyable anymore. So when they screw around with the rules, I don't think that always is helpful. But
all right. So let's, speaking of screwing around with the rules, look at that segue, Andy. You see that?
That was
professional podcast host right there.
Rich, there's not enough O's in smooth for that transition just there.
That's what Judge Mizell is accused of doing in a ruling striking down the CDC mask mandate on travel. You have very carefully evaluated this decision and sussed out what's good and what's bad, and unfortunately, I think somewhat convincingly made the case that when Charlie and I were discussing this on the editors earlier this week, that we were focusing on the statutory question, which is one of the weakest parts of her ruling. So I was focused on the word sanitation. Basically, the statute sets out a number of things that the federal government can do to stop the spread of disease, fumigation, pests, extermination, et cetera. So one question, and her decision puts a lot of weight on this, is whether sanitation is something that, you know, the authorities or folks on the airplane would do, or whether it's a requirement you can impose on a traveler. And Mizell says, no, it's something, you know, it's wiping down the seat back trays after people have left. It's something that's being affirmatively done, not imposed on people. But you point out, actually, prior to that portion of the statute, there's more comprehensive language, but I'll throw it over to you.
Well, I think I heard you and Charlie and the other guys on the editors go back and forth on this. And I think you ought to cut yourself some slack, because what she says in the opinion, which you would have to have read up on this closely to know that she's wrong about this, but what she says is that the Supreme Court has said that the statute is supposed to be written, construed this way. So there's two sentences in the statute. And one of them has a very clear license to the CDC where it says basically they are authorized to make and enforce such regulations as, in his judgment, him being the Secretary of Health and Human Services, but this is really the CDC, that they have the authority to make and enforce such regulations as in their judgment are necessary to prevent the introduction, transmission, or spread of communicable diseases. So that's not hortatory language. That's authorizing them in a very clear way to do that. And clearly, a mask mandate would come within this, because even whether it's an effective policy or not is a side question. It's obviously policy-wise, it's the most important question. But here we're not talking about the policy. We're talking about what does the law allow the government to do, not whether what the government does is smart. So I don't see how they could more clearly have authorized this. And her theory, Rich, that this subsection doesn't deal with preventing infection, it deals with cleansing infection. This gets to your point about what she did with the word sanitation, which I'll come to. But it's not credible to say that this subsection doesn't deal with prevention when it says in black and white that they're authorized to prevent the spread mm-hmm. of communicable diseases. So my point is that even if you didn't have the second section or the second sentence of the statute, which is where we get into sanitation, they would be authorized to do this. They don't have to rely on that. And what she said was two things, which I think are both, I don't want to say they were disingenuous, so I'll say that she has it wrong. But one thing she said was that the Supreme Court said that this is how you should construe the statute. And the second thing she said was that the Justice Department agreed that if the statute was to be, or if the mandate was to be upheld, it had to be upheld as a sanitation measure. And I think, number one, the Supreme Court didn't say that at all. And secondly, what the Justice Department was saying was that the mandate could be upheld as a sanitation measure, but they were not conceding that that was the only way mm-hmm. To uphold it. So I think she's wrong about that. And the thing is, Rich, I think she's entirely right about the policy. And she's right to say that, you know, this is ineffective. She's right to say that a mandate of this kind is a drastic shift in the division of authority between the federal government and the state governments, because the states have traditionally been supreme on matters of healthcare like this. She's quite right to say that when this statute was enacted 70 years ago, Congress had modest aims for it, and the enacting Congress probably would never have conceived that there would be a president would authorize a national mask mandate on account of that. All that stuff is true. But the thing is, the way statutory interpretation works, and this is like Justice Scalia 101, right? Textualism. All that stuff about policy and using policy in order to try to grapple with ambiguity in a statute only kicks in if you have an ambiguity. And if the law is clear, you're supposed to enforce the law based on the clear common understanding of the words in the statute. And she didn't do that here. What I think she did was manufacture ambiguity in order to bring to bear all of these policy arguments against the mandate. But all that stuff is irrelevant if the statute is clear, and it is clear. On sanitation, see, what she did here was she needs to read out the first sentence of the statute, because that's the clear authorization to the CDC to do something like this. So she turns it into hortatory language rather than, you know, actionable, applicable authority. So having read out the main part of the statute, she then moves on to this list that Congress put in the statute of the kinds of things that you can do in order to regulate for purposes of trying to stem the spread of disease. And it talks about, inspection, fumigation, disinfection, sanitation, pest extermination, destruction of animals that are diseased, and that sort of thing. She reads that as if it's what Congress says you're allowed to do, when it's clear from the plain language of the statute and what the Supreme Court has said about the statute that Congress meant that list to be illustrative of the kinds of things that you could do to regulate, but it wasn't meant to be an exhaustive list, which is clear from the fact that at the end of it, Congress also says other measures that it doesn't define to give them more authority to regulate. So she's acting as if those are the only things you're allowed to do. And what the Supreme Court has said is they're just the sorts of things that you're allowed to do. But, you know, it's all what the Supreme Court mainly says is what Congress allows in the statute is for the CDC to isolate and prevent the spread of disease. And if that's what you're doing, they're going to have a lot of rhythm to do that. And the case that she's relying on to say the Supreme Court had this constrictive interpretation of the statute is the mortgage moratorium case. And we talked about that at great length. The problem with the mortgage moratorium case is that it wasn't a healthcare measure. It wasn't really a measure to stop the spread of disease. It was a progressive economic regulation that they were disguising as if it was a measure to stop the spread of disease. So what the Supreme Court's problem with the mortgage moratorium was that it really didn't have anything to do with the spread of disease. You can't say that about masks. You know, you and I and you know, others who agree with us can make a lot of noise about the fact that masks are ineffective or masks don't work. But you can't say when they put a regulation in like this that they're not intending to try to stop the spread of disease.
But doesn't matter how effective they are or not.
Well, it matters, Rich, but you know, this gets into I want to circle back to sanitation, but it's important. But what you've hit on, I think, is the most important thing, which is if you read this statute, what becomes clear, and this goes to a lot of the things that we objected to during the Trump administration in terms of the courts invalidating President Trump's orders pursuant to immigration and border security statutes, right? If you read this statute, much like those statutes, the check on overregulation here is political. It's not legal. Because the statute says in two different places that the CDC can put in the regulations that in their judgment are necessary. It doesn't say in the judgment of the judiciary. What Congress said was in the judgment of the president, basically, of the executive branch. Now, Congress could have done this very differently, right? They could have said, we're going to let the executive branch do this, but here's the following five things that they have to, you know, these boxes that they have to check before they can do it. That's not what they did. They said, we are trusting this to the judgment and discretion of the executive branch. So the idea is if they get it wrong, the check on that is political. They're not saying, you know, this isn't an invitation to the judiciary to come in and second guess the politically accountable actors unless they do something here that's clearly illegal. And mm-hmm. I don't think anybody, no matter how you feel about this, I don't see how anybody could say that this was clearly illegal. You know, there's a lot of, look, we have profound objections to it because it doesn't work. It's a stupid policy. Right. But that stupid is very different from illegal.
Yeah. So she's on much stronger grounds when it comes to the APA, which has been the grounds on which a lot of regulations have been struck down over the last several years, but both Biden, Trump, Obama.
Yeah, I think, you know, look, they completely ignored the APA. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Charlie's made this point, and I think he's quite right about it. With DACA, when Obama did DACA, he didn't even comply, and nobody claimed that he did, with the APA in establishing DACA. You know, they put that out as a memo. That they said it was a memo from Jay Johnson, the head of Homeland Security back then. It wasn't even an executive order by Obama. And yet the Supreme Court said that because Trump didn't comply with the APA in removing DACA, that DACA got to stay, even though the previous administration hadn't followed the APA in establishing it. So here, you're dealing with a situation where Biden is purporting formally to promulgate a mandate. It's clear that they have to comply with the APA. They're not even contending that, not like Obama, oh, we just put this out as a memo for guidance to our agencies. This is a mandate that they put out as if it had the force of law. You can do that, but you have to comply with the APA. And they absolutely ignored the notice and comment period. Now, the notice and comment period is very important. I mean, a lot of this administrative stuff, I have to say, I was never the kind of lawyer who practiced administrative law. And I completely understand, because these regulation books get to be like the Manhattan phone book used to be, that it makes people's heads spin. It makes my head spin. But this is something that should be pretty clear and understandable to people. The worry with the administrative state is that we're being ruled by technocrats and you know, these faceless bureaucrats who are not really accountable to us. It's not like when Congress makes bad law and we can like vote them out of office. These bureaucrats go on, they're like almost like judges. They go on forever and they're kind of unreachable to us. So in order to grapple with the anti-democratic nature of the administrative state, the notice and comment provision is there for two reasons. One is to democratize the process. In other words, this actually is where the public gets to weigh in. And it's expected that the agency will listen to the comments, especially by people who are going to be regulated and are going to have to live in a concrete way with whatever it is the government wants to do. And it's expected that they listen and that they will adjust their regulations accordingly. So that's one big part of it. And it's part of why you have to comply. The other thing about the notice and comment rule is that the assumption of it is that hearing from the public improves regulation and therefore is a necessary part of the process. And for the Biden administration to come in and very arrogantly say, we didn't need to comply with the notice and comment period because this was an emergency measure and it was simply common sense that you should have mask mandates, completely undoes the underlying assumption that the reason you turn to the public for input is because it improves the regulation. The government doesn't get to say, we don't need to do this because we've decided this is common sense. The public will tell you what common sense is. So they have to comply with that, and they didn't. So the strongest part, I think, of Judge Mizell's ruling is her conclusion that they have failed to comply with the Administrative Procedures Act. And whether she's right or wrong, I think she's wrong, but whether she's right or wrong on her textual argument, they haven't complied with the APA. And for that reason alone, the ruling is correct insofar as finding that they're in violation of law.
All right. So for those keeping track at home, we got wrong on the statutory interpretation, correct on the APA. And now for the tiebreaker, was she correct on the remedy? Andy?
All right. So I think no. And, you know, there's a spirited debate about this. And my problem with it, Rich, is I don't have any problem with her making a ruling that the regulation is invalid. Mm-hmm. What I have a problem with is the same thing I had a problem with during the Trump years, which is a district judge, an unaccountable judicial official in a single one of 94 federal districts, issuing a ruling that purports to undo the action of the president nationwide, where she doesn't have any jurisdiction, in connection with a matter that Congress explicitly commits to the discretion and judgment of the executive branch. I don't think she has authority, and I don't think she should have authority to do anything other than rule on the case. And what that would mean is that the government can't enforce unless they appeal and they win, the government can't enforce the regulation against the plaintiffs in the case. And then if other plaintiffs want to go in around the country and file actions against the regulation, they're free to do that. And if Congress wants to look at this and say, you know, obviously we need to jump in here and take some curative action, they can do that. And if the attention that all of this draws is it causes the public to think that, you know, the Biden administration is abusing its power by flouting the APA and by sticking to this mandate, which is ineffective and is, you know, if it was ever effective, that was a long time ago. We're now in a very different point in the pandemic. But I don't think it's right. And I'm not the only one who says this. You know, the Supreme Court, Justice Thomas has come out. He calls these universal injunctions, not just nationwide injunctions. There are judges on the Supreme, justices on the Supreme Court have obviously had a problem with this idea that district judges think that they can not only resolve the case before them, but issue, you know, like in the Trump years, everybody used to file immigration suits in Hawaii, right? So they could get in front of that judge who was Obama's classmate at Harvard, and miraculously he decided all Trump's immigration orders were illegal, even though they tracked the statutes that he was relying on. So this is a game. I don't think, you know, we shouldn't invite this kind of forum shopping, but more importantly, we're not supposed to be ruled by unaccountable judges. That's not the way that this is supposed to work. Now, just to give the other side its due, as a practical matter, if the government is a party to the suit, you can understand why people think it has to be a nationwide mandate or a nationwide ruling, because even if the plaintiffs in the suit are not nationwide, the government is. Right. Mm-hmm. So you can understand the rationale for this. But I simply, you know, if another litigant went into the Southern District of New York today and raised the same issue, and a judge in the Southern District of New York said, I don't know from Judge Mizell, but this looks fine to me. And I don't think the Administrative Procedure Act, I'm going to hold that it's harmless error that they didn't comply with the notice and comment period, and I'm going to uphold it. So, well, then you have conflicting district judges around the country on the same thing. That should get worked out in the regular litigation process. I don't think you should have a district judge presume to issue something that's a ruling that basically undoes the policy of the political branches to which this question is committed. All across the country, outside the judge's jurisdiction. It just doesn't, I don't think that's the way we're supposed to be governed.
And then finally, Andy, before we get to Durham and Sussman, so the Biden administration seems to be in a weird place here where they don't really want this thing reinstituted and to have to tell everyone to wear masks again when people were celebrating and the airlines and everyone was like, thank God, it's finally over. But then they don't want to cede the point on principle either. So what, how do you read their legal strategy?
Well, I think here's the problem they have, Rich, is that among the most rambunctious part of their base is the lawyer left. And they want this to be appealed, right? And they have trouble containing those people. Unlike, you know, the great unwashed, the lawyers know the law, right? So, you know, they don't take well to Biden telling them that, we're not sure. The courts have shut us down here. There's nothing more we can. That's what he'd like to be able to say, but they're not going to put up with that because they know he can appeal. So at the same time, the mask mandate is unpopular. You know, I know there was polling that came out. I don't believe the polling. I mean, I know that sounds... we have people who say we don't believe the polling all the time and we kind of roll our eyes at it, but I find it hard to believe the polling that came out that said like 60% of people want the mandates to continue. You know, I've been getting around the country a little bit. I don't think people like the mandates, but whether the polling is right or it's not right, there's going to be massive opposition if Biden tries to reinstate this, and he knows it'll be politically damaging, and he's taking water in all kinds of directions now as it is. So what I think they're trying to do here, Rich, is say they're going to appeal, knowing they have 30 days to appeal, and that within that 30 days, the mask mandate was going to lapse anyway. The tell here is if they really wanted to appeal, they would march into the 11th Circuit and ask for a stay. Mm-hmm. But they know that would result in everybody having to put the masks on again, right? They'd have to do that. So there's a doctrine of law. Steve Vladek has talked about this, a law professor down in Texas. He's talked about this in the New York Times in one of the stories today. There's a doctrine of law basically that says that if a case becomes moot for reasons outside the litigation, the government can appeal within its time to appeal, and it can argue that the case has become moot and urge the Court of Appeals to remand the case to the district court with instructions to get rid of its decision because the case is moot now anyway. So there's no point in continuing to litigate it. So what I think the Biden people are trying to do is run out the clock on the mandate, then file their appeal saying that the case is moot and hope that the 11th Circuit will remand it to Judge Mizell with instructions to vacate her opinion. I don't think the 11th Circuit is going to do that, but I think that's what they think their best strategy is right now.
So there is a famous SNL episode with spoofing Jesse Jackson where he was saying constantly, the question is moot. So that would be the strategy here. So let's go to Sussman. We have another filing giving us another piece of information here that does not look good for Sussman.
Yeah, well, there's all the stuff that's come out from Durham in the last 2 months hasn't looked too good for Sussman. And I guess that it's a credit to Durham that, you know, even though you had half the people saying that, you know, he shouldn't be doing this investigation at all, that was the Democrats. And then on the pro-Trump side, they were like, you know, he's a fumbling, bumbling, stumbling guy who can't seem to get to the finish line. Well, now we're getting, you know, he's indicted someone, we're getting close to trial, and he's gearing up. And it looks like he's got some, you know, very powerful cards to play in the case. And he's not a guy who leaks. So we haven't gotten a sense up until now of the strength of his case. And now is when you get a sense of the strength of the case, because they're in the phase, Rich, where they have what's called motions in limine, which is basically you don't want to waste the jury's time.
What?
In limine. So what it means is each side is trying to basically restrict what the other side can prove during the trial. So what the defense does is try to go in and stop the prosecutor from being able to put in, you know, X, Y, and Z proof, and the government, you know, pushes back on that. And where Durham knows that he's trying to put in evidence that may be controversial at the trial, he makes a pretrial motion to get it in so that they can argue it now rather than waste time in front of the jury when the trial starts. So that's the phase we're in now. And my particular favorite of all of this is just hilarious. The as people will remember, Sussman's been indicted for lying to the FBI. And what he was lying to the FBI about was to conceal the fact that he was working, representing the Clinton campaign and this guy, Rodney Jaffe, who was a tech executive who put all this internet data together to try to suggest that there was a Trump-Russia back channel, communications back channel. So Sussman was representing the Clinton campaign and Jaffe when he went into the FBI, yet he told the FBI, this is one of the things that Durham has revealed in the last couple of months, he sends a text to the general counsel of the FBI, Jim Baker at the time, saying, I want to bring you this information about Trump. I'm not representing anyone. I just want to help the Bureau. That's what it says in the text. So the theory of the case is that Sussman lied to conceal the fact that he was representing Jaffe and the Clinton campaign. So one of the motions in limine that the Sussman defense has filed is Durham intends to put in a trial all these things that he subpoenaed from the Clinton campaign and Jaffe that they haven't turned over to him or that they've turned over in a redacted way, because with respect to portions of them, they're asserting the attorney-client privilege. So Sussman figures, this may not be very good for my case if my position is that I wasn't representing anyone, and the evidence is that these guys are keeping stuff from Durham based on the attorney-client privilege that I, in a case where I said there was no attorney-client relationship. So that's pretty interesting. The thing that's gotten the most attention is Durham has explained that the FBI and the CIA looked at the information that Sussman proffered. Sussman meets with the FBI in September of 2016. He has a second meeting with the CIA in February of 2017, where he's trying to urge on them the same materials. And you probably remember, Rich, about 2 months ago, we talked at some length about this because there was such a stir over the fact that Durham had revealed in one of his court filings that there were these records from the White House that were said to implicate Trump in a communications network with the Russians. And what, you know, the New York Times said and the Sussman camp said is that's a ridiculous claim, because the records here are from 2014 to early 2017. That was when Obama was president. There's no way that Sussman would take Obama records and try to smear Trump with them. And we pointed out at the time that, you know, first of all, Trump was president in the early part of 2017. And secondly, Durham clearly wasn't hiding the ball, because in his motion, he mentions that these are mostly Obama era records, which is a fact that helps him in the case, because what he says they show is that what Sussman was contending was a suspicious pattern of communications. If you go back and look at the Obama stuff, it's not suspicious at all. It's commonplace. So
Sussman's using the Obama stuff as a baseline.
Well, Durham is using it as a baseline. Sussman was using it, just cherry picking the Trump stuff to try to suggest it was suspicious.
And so is Durham saying there is equal amount of pings or whatever the.
Right. So the last thing in the world Durham wants to do is try to hide the fact that it's Obama records, not Trump. And what would be the point? The judge knows who was president from 2014 to 2017, the jury's going to know. So it was ridiculous to think that Durham was like hiding the ball and trying to do something dishonest on that. But P.S. Rich, in the last couple of days, Durham has put out more information, which specifically shows that what Sussman brought was records of what's known as a Yoda phone, which is a Russian-made cell phone that apparently has connections to people who are connected to the Kremlin.
I'm going to stick with my iPhone.
Yeah, probably better. But the Yoda phone that they say that they claim to Trump, or that Sussman claimed could be tied to Trump, was actually picked up in the executive office of the president, which is the servers at the White House, in December of 2016. So that shows that as we discussed 2 months ago, there was plenty of reason to think that there might be Trump pings after the election, because the transition was going on, the administration was getting up and running. And we knew at that point that Sussman had met with the CIA on February 17th, which was almost a month into the Trump administration. So there was no reason to think that all of these records pertained to Obama. And now we know, some of them pertain to Trump. But the important thing here, Rich, is very interestingly, Durham says the CIA looked at this and decided it was bunk. In other words, these records, they decided it was bogus, that it was fabricated, spoofed, internally inconsistent, et cetera. So there's been a lot of reporting that has run with that. It was a big story the last few days. And what I would caution people is that Durham, even though this didn't get a lot of attention in the coverage, if you look carefully at what Durham says in his motion, he says that the FBI looked at the same information but did not draw a conclusion that it was bogus. Now, he's not saying that they drew a conclusion that it wasn't bogus. And in fact, the FBI dropped the Alpha Bank investigation because they didn't think there was anything there. But the CIA is ahead of where the FBI could be in terms of analyzing these records. And most importantly, Durham himself says that he hasn't made up his mind whether these are bogus or not, whether this was completely fabricated or not. And I think the reason this is important ties into the last thing I'll mention, which is Sussman wants to call Jaffe as a witness. Durham won't allow that to happen because he's not immunizing Jaffe. Jaffe needs to get immunized before he'll testify because he's worried that he's going to be prosecuted. And what Durham has come out and said is, Jaffe is still the subject of my investigation. So that's a sign that Durham is still pursuing a theory that there was a massive fraud on the government here. He just hasn't made up his mind yet whether these records are a complete fabrication or whether there was something to them. Now, I can understand people being frustrated about that. You would think by this point, he should have made up his mind about that one way or the other. But I just think it's interesting. This is still a continuing investigation. The Sussman trial is a false statements trial. It's not a fraud on the government trial. But Durham hasn't stopped investigating yet. And there could be more. I have thought up till now that we're kind of winding down to the end. He's making noises the last couple of weeks that maybe he's not.
Okay, well, that's all the time we have this week. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich.